Gina gets here. We have a pretty full agenda today of HDR 31 relating to pollution reduction, prevention, waste reduction, and recycling. HDR 17 relating to task force and governmental roles. HB 171 prohibited sealing of certain court records. And HB 225 related to retirement credit for unused sick leave. And we'll also bring back up HB 188, which was held over from Wednesday, Representative Foster's bill. We'll start this morning with HDR 31. To represent Ulmer, we have Susan Erickson from her office. If you'd state your name and set her for the record. And
I need to turn this on.
Are we on telecoms? Not yet.
Okay, my name is Susan Erickson. I'm here on behalf of Representative Fran Ulmer. I'm here to talk about HJR 31 relating to pollution prevention, waste reduction, and recycling. What this resolution does is create the week of April 21st through 27th as Waste Reduction and Recycling Week in Alaska. The intent of the resolution is to create a focus for various community groups, local and state government organizations to work together to provide community education and awareness about recycling and waste reduction. I think over the past several years we've witnessed an increase in these kinds of groups, different levels of government in different communities, and it'll bring these groups together for one common focus that week. It also ties into Earth Day events, which are designated April 15th. What the resolution does is tap into Juno events that are already planned to use Juno as a model and encourage other communities to produce similar events. It's coming up pretty quick, and so this is kind of going to be a fast first year, and hopefully next year more events so that the state will be able to be planned.
Thank you, Susan. I note for the record that Representative Choquette was here at 8:21 and left at 8:22. Any questions for Ms. Erickson? Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would appreciate, I think in the future, I think all the members would, if there would be a little bit more backup, as much as that you named Senate Joint Resolution 70 and House Joint Resolution 169 of the U.S. Congress. I know myself and I'm sure other members, before we vote, you know, we don't know what they say. Mm-hmm. And I think the resolution is good, but I don't know what those two resolutions in Congress says. Mm-hmm. And they could have some real zingers in them. Mm-hmm. That could be critical to Alaska. So before we send a message saying, you know, we support those, I would like to know what they say. But that's just a point of information for the sponsor or anybody else that wants us to support some resolutions in Congress. We need to know what they say. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Point well taken, Representative Miller. Any other questions for Ms. Erickson? If not, thank you very much. Next on the witness register, we have Jeff Mock from the Department of Environmental Conservation. Mr. Mock, welcome to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Mock. I'm Chief of the Solid and Hazardous Waste Management Section for the Department of Environmental Conservation. It's a mouthful this early in the morning. I'd like to say that the department strongly supports this resolution. Pollution prevention, particularly through waste reduction and recycling, should be everyone's first choice as a strategy in dealing with waste management issues. In the past 2 years, our department has been very active. The number of projects in pollution prevention, particularly in the areas of solid waste and hazardous waste management. As waste management requirements become more stringent, waste management costs continue to rise, new facilities become more difficult to site, pollution prevention will become an increasingly important element in developing solutions to Alaskans' hazardous waste and solid waste problems.
Brief testimony this morning. Representative Miller.
I'm going to ask the witness, does he know what either one of those resolutions in Congress say?
I have not seen either of them.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, I was just reading the language, and it said they've been introduced, but it does not say that they have passed either.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have no further names on the witness. Is there anyone wishing to testify? Jeff, that does have a zero fiscal note, doesn't it?
Friday till we can review those two resolutions. Or Monday, but today is.
That's true.
What day of the week is it? We move to postpone until Monday until we can review those and calendar this for the first thing Monday morning.
That suits me, as vice chairman. Let's see what our chairman thinks. Perhaps, is there any possibility of getting those while the meeting's going on? I see Susan shaking her head, yes.
What? I'm sorry.
Looking for the federal resolutions. Let's put that aside momentarily then and go to HCR 17, Representative Blair. HCR 17 was in subcommittee relating to task force of government roles. I understand we have a letter to finance as a result of that meeting.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. There should be a proposed letter to the House Finance Committee in your packets. I met with the subcommittee twice, and we focused primarily on the fiscal note, and that is, or the letter to the House Finance Committee, I think, is a product of that consideration. And essentially, what the suggestion of this subcommittee, or to the subcommittee, to the full committee here, would be to have the Finance Committee consider a reduction in the fiscal note by $210,000, and that would chiefly manifest in the reduction of the specific staff to the project that we'd outlined in the original fiscal note, totaling $210,000. And the reason why it's coming in this form rather than just a reduction, a wholesale reduction in that, is to give the chairman of the Finance Committee and myself some additional time and opportunity to work out this agreement with OMB and Community and Regional Affairs so that we can make sure that we have dedicated staff to this purpose. And I'm confident that we can get that dedicated staff. And once that is taken care of, we can make that reduction in the fiscal note. It's not an insignificant amount of money. So that's why we would prefer this type of letter so that we can continue to have the flexibility to work with them. That's my expectation, that we will actually see in fact, the reduction may be larger than this.
Thank you, Representative Blair. Are there any questions for Representative Bruckman?
The balance then was $400,000.
Middle of the $400,000.
Right. No further questions. Thank you, Representative Blair. Is there any wishing to testify on this resolution? Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
No, I didn't sleep in.
If there's no further testimony, HCR 17, I would entertain a motion.
So I would move, Mr. Chairman, that it be passed out of committee with that.
Unanimous consent. No objections. HCR 17 is moved in committee, and at this time I'd like to return the meeting to Representative Vina, the chairman.
If we did.
Mr. Chairman, could we add our amendment to include the fiscal note letter to 10?
Yes, of course, with the letter of finance included.
Right.
In the motion.
Who are we on teleconference for, James?
Anchorage for 171.
Okay.
Richard's
next bill before us would be House Bill 179 by the House Judiciary Committee. House Bill 171 would amend the State Code of Civil Procedures to prohibit courts from sealing documents that contain information concerning public hazards. We're still waiting for a fiscal note from the court system, so we'll not be able to move 171 this morning. It's my intent to hear testimony on 171. Reschedule the bill for additional hearing within the next year. This time I'd like to invite Representative Donnelly. Is he on his way? Or Hayden? Since we're waiting for Representative Donnelly, we'll take a couple minutes and deal with House Bill 188. House Bill 188.
We've got a couple of copies. Oh, wait. This is the latest version. The extra copies.
Does everybody have a CS for 188? House Bill 188 was before the committee on Wednesday, I believe. Was put into subcommittee. Could I have a subcommittee report? Representative Broomberg.
Oh, Representative Choquette is the subcommittee chair.
Representative Choquette.
Representative Choquette, would defer to Representative Broomberg.
Representative Broomberg.
I'll defer to Representative Choquette.
Are we on teleconference?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. It'll be listened. Go ahead. Representative Broomberg.
No, go ahead.
Okay. We had a subcommittee meeting under the able and courageous leadership of Representative Choquette yesterday, Representative Foster, and Representative Choquette and our staff were there. And we worked on this. And what we did, Mr. Chairman, just sort of going by line by line in this thing, the first three lines are basically the same as the last version of the bill. We indicated that Alaska residents would be eligible as determined by the department by regulation, and that is basically with the understanding they're probably going to use the home station, home of record concept, if people have been Alaskans when they went into the service, even if they're stationed out of Alaska at the time they went to the Persian Gulf. Or number two, people on permanent station in Alaska, as opposed to temporary due to TDY, would also be eligible. So that even if a person were stationed at Elmendorf or someplace and home of record were Ohio or something, they would still be eligible as long as they went from there to the Persian Gulf. So those two classes of people. It wouldn't be enough if they were on active duty. They would have to have served in the Persian Gulf and nearby areas and in response to the conflict. Those lines 10 and 11. And then we took from the Davis bill some language that the department shall contract, and that would be under the procurement code, or otherwise arrange for the minting of medallions from 0.999 fine silver in a way to be determined by the Adjutant General, and that's from the Davis Act. And the plan was silver.
Thank you.
And we did not use the concept of having been mined in Alaska because when they take the silver out of the Greens Creek mine, it's commingled and it goes all around the world and they can't tell where the silver is from. That's just physically impossible. And the design would be determined in a competition conducted by the department from among... And there's a typographical error here, Mr. Chairman. On page 2, line 1, it should be from among.
Okay.
After the word department, I think there should be the word from. The statute, the sentence should read, the design for the medallion shall be determined in a competition conducted by the department from among Alaska residents. Is that grammatically correct?
Yes.
So when I offer the when I offer the CS, I will offer it with that one-word amendment, Mr. Chairman, after the word department, adding the word from. I think that's dramatically for us.
Thank you.
Is that amongst?
Not unless you're in a seminary.
There must be some type.
AMORGST.
And then it says the department shall award $1,000 to the winner, and there's an immediate effective date. We have a legal opinion that we'll get copies to you. I only have one. Let me read it in the record, Mr. Chairman, so people know. Not, you don't need it. Okay. Yes, no.
What's the list?
It's a legal opinion on one aspect of the bill. Terry Bannister was concerned that the this says Alaskan residents, and that the restriction of the design competition to Alaska residents raises an issue under the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the U.S. Constitution. If a right to participate is a fundamental right, the clause applies and must be satisfied. But although this right does not seem very fundamental at first glance, you can argue that some artists earn their living by the money they receive from government art competition. If considered, the clause would apply, and they would have to show a substantial justification, and et cetera. It's unclear whether the arguments would satisfy this criteria. The state's giving leeway in preferring its own residents to its own activities, so it's really unclear about this. The state could make a healthy argument. It's entitled to deference in this case, since the restricted activity is limited to a single event and to only $1,000. I don't think anybody would ever challenge it, but I wanted to put that on the record, and we'll make sure that copies of that are given to everyone. So if you'd like, I'll move the CS.
Would like a motion on the CS?
Okay. I would move the CS with the word from added after department on page 2, line 1.
Is there any objection to having the CS before us for discussion purposes?
No objection.
Hearing no objections. Representative Foster, have you reviewed the CS?
Yes, I have. We had a meeting yesterday, and I think we went along with all the ideas that Representative Gruenberg and Choquette had, and I believe that the bill is ready to pass.
Representative Choquette, any further comments?
One further comment, Mr. Chairman. You'll note that we have a new fiscal note that reduces the cost of the project $20,000 in terms of search and seizure.
The record should show that we do have a $50,000 fiscal note from Military and Veterans Affairs. Representative Bruckman?
My concerns were taken care of already.
Any further discussion on the committee substitute reports?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill, please.
No further discussion. Motion is in order. There's a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Is there any objection? House Bill 188 is moved to the committee with individual recommendations. Thank you, Representative Foster.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It's interesting. Just one thing.
Representative Gruenberg.
The citation production costs actually increased $1,500 on the list.
Representative Donnelly?
From 7.5.
Is this really it? I can go get him now.
Well, we'll wait again, Hayden.
Well, he waited for about 40 minutes.
Go to the next one.
Mr. Chairman, we can take and move this rec bill on. Later. Which one?
Move to suspend the rules and move to unfinished business temporarily.
What's that number on that?
KCR.
No, let's wait and get the files and do it on Monday, all right?
I just do
have to do here, but...
Representative Donnelly, would you join the committee, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Donnelly, House Judiciary Prime Sponsor, could you give us a little overview on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, are we on teleconference?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. House Bill 171 would do what the states of Florida, Texas, I guess in one form or another, Virginia, Missouri, Rhode Island, Maryland, and New York have done, and that's to prohibit secret settlements of civil litigation where there's a public hazard at issue. And that's like, if there's a classic case of this, is if somebody's harmed by a drug that's on the market and there's a settlement out of court, and part of the settlement is that that information be kept secret so that the harm does not go away but continues to be out there threatening the lives or health of people, that would not be allowed. That information would be public. It would apply to other types of suits also. So I guess it would apply to products liability suits, oil companies for oil spill damage suits, professionals such as lawyers and doctors in malpractice suits. And traditionally, many of these types of things, defendants have asked when they settle to keep the settlement secret so that the hazard is concealed from the public, and the public doesn't have the information to protect itself. So this would simply say that you could not allow this where the information is a public hazard. I might ask a special permission of the committee that if Catherine Colquhurst or anybody from Rudy, Bradley, and Colquhurst happen to be in the audience today or signed up to testify, I would like the opportunity to ask them a few questions, Mr. Chairman, since in their memorandum, which is in the committee files, they seem to have psychic powers, and they identified that my real reason for introducing this bill was something that I never even crossed my mind. But I'd sure like to ask them how they can ascertain that, but they're without ever speaking to me. And with I'd like to be able to read minds like that too, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly, afford you the opportunity to question everyone that you testifies, Representative Donnelly. Questions of Representative Donnelly from the committee? Representative Bruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Donnelly, I think you were familiar somewhat with the suit that involved the Anchorage School District in an asbestos settlement where the court determined that it had to be open to public records. How would your bill affect that legislation or that court decision?
Through the chair,
Representative
Bruckman, that wouldn't affect, this legislation wouldn't affect that because that decision was based on our open meetings and open records law, which applies to governmental entities. That decision wouldn't apply to individual plaintiffs because they're not governments acting, and so they're not subject to the open records law.
Other questions of the committee? Donnelly, maybe you can grab another chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can slide over on the side. James can sit on the heater there.
See, I've never taken a chair from a commissioner before.
If you do it too long, you have to be confirmed.
Yeah.
I would like to hear from Mary Norance first. Is Mary here?
Mary
Nordale.
Oh, Nordale. I'm sorry, Mary. It's just I can't read very well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I prepared written comments and asked that they be distributed to all of you, and I know that you have a lot of witnesses lined up to testify, so I don't want to take too much time. One
if,
thing...
If you would maybe at least summarize what your opposition, because we did just get this, but not need it.
I represent the American Insurance Association, which is an industry group of approximately 250 insurance companies. The focus of my testimony is that because the bill is so broad, both in terms of when disclosure can be required and the lack of real definition with respect to a public hazard, that litigation will become so expensive, so voluminous, that it will basically bar the courtrooms to private litigants. And the state will take on a load of expense in order to deal with the questions that will have to be answered by the courts. It's my estimate that it would take probably 5 to 10 new judges in order to cope with the volume of work that would be required. One of the reasons for that is that with the expanded jurisdiction of the district court, many cases which formerly would have been tried in the Superior Court would be tried in the district court. And the district court's dockets are fairly full.
Could I interrupt? Could
sure.
you explain to me why this would, a little more, why this would, you think, would take 5 to 10 more judges?
Yes. The bill talks about a public hazard, but basically the definition of what that public hazard is so broad that each case would have to be decided on its merits. So if someone wanted to intervene to claim that the lawsuit involved a public hazard, the court would have to make a determination, one, of whether or not the person seeking to intervene had an interest. And the definition of an interested person is likewise so broad that it would mean almost anyone. Secondly, then, the court would have to make a determination of whether or not a hazard exists, and whether or not it was a public hazard, and whether or not the information sought by the intervener at any particular stage of discovery was, in fact, relevant to the issue of public hazard. This would mean, then, that the court would have decided ultimate facts in the case prior to the parties ever being able to reach trial, either before court or jury. And this progress of discovery would be so burdensome and so voluminous as far as the courts are concerned, because they would have to render a determination of public hazard with respect to each case in which something but it falls within the definition of the statute was involved. And and because the definition is so broad, almost anything falls within the definition of public hazard. Normally, in a situation when you're dealing with something that would be designated a public hazard, the legislature has acted and has defined public hazard and has defined a regulatory scheme to control and protect the public. But in this instance, the entire burden would be thrust upon the courts for making that determination, and as a consequence, we would have the courts, I think, truly bogged down. And I think that a 5 to 10 judge increase in our judicial system is a fairly conservative one as our population grows, and the benefits to litigants, not to the intervener litigants, becomes more apparent. I would like to bring to the attention of the committee what I think is an omission in terms of amendments to the civil rules. I think it also amends Civil Rule 60, which is the rule which governs reopening of judgments. And it basically is a rule, in some respects, of repose, so that at some time judgments may be final. In this bill, if enacted, no judgment would be final if, in fact, there had ever been a determination of public hazard. And therefore, a defendant could be put to the burden of defending almost forever, interminably. Obviously, that imposes an economic burden on any business and creates a climate of uncertainty in the state of Alaska that I think would be inimical. And to the people and the consumers themselves. Do you have any questions?
Good questions from the committee. Representative Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Ordell. Obviously, this has a lot more judicial ramifications for the Judiciary Committee than for this committee. But from our point of view, and you represent the Insurance Association.
Right, correct.
Is there any duty on the part of an insurer or a defendant if they fail to take action to correct some kind of a public danger?
Well, I think, Mr. Gruber, through the chair, that first of all, you have to define what a public danger is.
I'm assuming we have a clear public danger. I don't want to get lose sight of the forest for the trees. I'm trying to get to a particular point. Let me just make myself clear. If there is a known public danger, like let's say a major defect in a product, and there is a lawsuit that's brought, or a series of lawsuits, and the defendant fails to take action to pull cyanide-containing tablets off the shelf or something knowingly, that may lead to very considerable liability on the part of that defendant, may it not?
Oh, assuredly. I think that the Stern-Ruger case is a very good example of that particular type of thing. But there is no law that requires Stern-Ruger to make good guns.
There is
certainly economic pressure.
There's no law requiring that weapons meet, for example, federal standards?
I don't know that there are any federal standards for weapons. If there are, that would have constituted a congressional determination of what a public hazard is, and I think that really poses in sharp contrast what this bill does. I mean, this bill creates a very muddy arena. If the Congress had made standards through the regulatory process as to what constituted a safe weapon.
Well, I think you're anticipating my next question, Mr. Chairman. Assume that there is a duty to correct known defects. Would this bill not make certain, provide an impetus to the manufacturer and specifically to the insurer to limit their liability by making certain that these corrective measures were changed? If something's publicized, that will provide an impetus to correct the defect and thereby reduce the exposure of the insurance industry and actually help you, wouldn't it?
I doubt it. I really don't think that the process is that simple, and I think that it poses for the legislature a very significant duty to determine whether or not they will engage in the regulation of products, of instrumentalities, or whatever, so that people know what are public hazards. The assumption you're making is that in the event of an accident or an event, that a public hazard exists. But I'm suggesting to you that that may not be the case, and you don't know whether or not a public hazard exists until the final determination has been made. Because in many instances, it's a misuse of a product, an instrumentality, whatever it is. And I think that an adverse judgment on one company or one distributor or one corner grocery store with respect to a particular item is not necessarily a declaration of a public hazard.
Well, I realize what you're saying, but that's not exactly my question. The concern, I think, that the sponsors of the bill had was that if there is something that is truly a public hazard or a danger to the public, and I'm not getting quibbling on details here, that it is our desire to ensure that this is corrected. And if we can do that, and ensure that it's corrected, it's in everybody's benefit, in the insurance industries as well, isn't it?
I would assume, yes, if in fact the legislature sets up a scheme for regulating the distribution or use of what it has deemed to be a public hazard, so that all the public is protected all of the time. Lawsuits are not the way to govern. They certainly are individual justice, but they are not blanket justice for everyone. And the problem, I think, that this legislation poses is that it leaves to the court the regulatory process, which is really the legislative process.
Is the insurance industry willing to take this task on?
Take what task on?
The task of protecting the public. The insurance industry...
I think that the insurance industry participates very strongly in the protection of the public. But it is not in the position of assuming the legislative powers to define what a public hazard is. That is a legislative determination.
The insurance industry, in fact, does this, though, Mr. Chairman, every day when they set rates.
Of course they do. That's a matter of risk. It is not a legislative determination of what a public hazard is.
But the determination of risk and the cost of premiums is directly related to the extent of the hazard and the exposure of the insurance industry. They do it in an economic sense every day.
That's correct. But at the same time, they are not making a legislative determination. They are making a risk determination. And if it is the desire of the legislature to create an arena for the regulation of public hazards, then it can establish a state agency and set up the type of regulatory regime that would be required to, one, define what public hazards are and ensure that people are not exposed to them.
Does the public have a right to know if there's a public hazard? And is there a duty, you know, at least a moral sense, on the part of an insurance industry, which is in very, very definitely a regulated industry, a duty to inform the public, a duty to help make certain that that hazard is corrected? Or is the insurance industry totally without any responsibility in this area?
No, I think everybody has a responsibility, but I think that the responsibility for definition of a public hazard rests with the legislature.
Thank you. Further questions of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Lindo. Is there anyone here from the court system? Christensen? Mr. Christensen? No. Again, it's hard for me to read the name here. Kathy?
Yes.
Cole Course. And would you state your name and address for the record, and be prepared for some questions from Representative Donnelly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Colhorst. I'm with the law firm of Ruddy Bradley and Colhorst at the Jordan Creek Center, and I'm here to represent the Lawyers for Civil Justice and the Motor Vehicles Manufacturers Association. I had comments that were distributed to the committee. Did all of the members of the committee receive them?
We do have those in our packet.
I was speaking with one of my partners about this bill, and he said it reminded him of an Irish saying that I wanted to share with the committee, because I think it had something to do with the origin of the Donnybrook. And he said the bill reminded him of the saying that went, "Is this a private fight or can anyone join in?" And I think that that really is the essence of what this bill would do. It would take the privacy of the fight, or the fact that courts are set up to handle litigation or disputes between two individuals, or an individual and a corporation, or two corporations. It's a private fight. And this bill would open it up to the public. It would let the public come in and ask for protective orders and settlement agreements that have some confidentiality under the existing rules. And if I could summarize my statements before I receive the questions from Representative Donnelly. And also, I do want to say, it's my understanding that this bill is model legislation that has been introduced in, I believe Representative Donnelly cited, 7 or 8 different states. It has been passed in 2, as is my understanding. And I believe my information is that it came out of the Association of Trial Lawyers, which met in 1989 and voted to make a 50-state push to pass this particular bill. I didn't mean to impugn Representative Donnelly's motives at all. It's my understanding that he did not write this bill, that this is modeled legislation, and it comes out of the plaintiff's bar. And the information that I gave in my statement regarding the copycat litigation that unfortunately is created when this kind of information is distributed widely, I think is a negative impact that the committee needs to consider. There are times when a person who is injured is faced with some lawyers coming and saying, "You were injured. Well, surely we can find someone to sue." And if you sue this company, here we have all this information that we can use on your case. I think it's an unfortunate consequence that legislation that the plaintiff's bar is interested in pursuing. And I am representing the defense bar, which are the lawyers who defend the people who make the snow machines. When a snow machine gear breaks and it injures a person, say, takes a finger, the plaintiff will sue if he believes that there is a defect. The question that is before this committee is whether or not a gear that breaks in a snow machine, for example, is a public hazard. Under the current definition, it certainly could be argued that this is a public hazard because the snow machine is going to continue to be made unless you try to prevent the manufacture of these snow machines. Therefore, this is a public hazard. And if you did that, you would lift you would permit the plaintiff to get the entire blueprint of the snow machine because it's relevant. Under the existing procedural evidentiary rules, it's relevant because, say, a gear broke and it injured a particular person. You can discover the entire blueprint of the snow machine. You cannot, the manufacturer, and the manufacturers are interested in limiting the trade secrets and the proprietary information. They've invested a whole lot of time and energy in preparing a particular gear, and the fact that it injures one person doesn't automatically make it a public hazard. For example, suppose the person drove the snow machine without oil for 2 months. Suppose they were riding it over rocks and not on snow. These are the kinds of things that are handled in a private dispute. The injured person sues the manufacturer. The court system, under our system of separation of powers, determines the outcome of that private litigation. If you pass this bill, you make it a public brouhaha. You make any person who believes that they ought to have General Motors or Chrysler's blueprints for the snow machine or the car, you are giving it to them. You would be taking proprietary information away if, under this definition, a public hazard is anything that hurts somebody and is going to continue to be manufactured. Perhaps what I'm making is, in general, there's a separation of powers idea, is that the legislature has a particular role, the court system has a particular role, and then the executive branch has a particular role. It's my opinion that this bill intrudes into the discretion of the court system. Right now, the court system has discretion to issue protective orders under certain circumstances, and this would strip all that discretion away from the court system.
Yeah, are you saying that it's not our, that we're out of line, we're out of place from changing those rules as a legislature?
No, it's my understanding that the legislature on a two-thirds majority has the right to direct the court system to take certain functions or undertake certain procedures and can change those rules. My argument is just that this is a very large intrusion into the discretion of the court system for what appears to me to be an illusory game.
We take a question, Representative Bruckman.
I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, the speaker. I found your argument confusing to a layperson because my court actually is open to an audience, the public sitting in the courtroom and listening, unless it involves very sensitive issues, minors, etc. Once the part is manufactured and the snow machine's available for sale, I would think anybody could look it over and make their own blueprints of talking. And if there is a part that's a defect, I sincerely feel that the public does have that right to know. And the court, you know, the decision in court, of course, would affect the sales of that. So in other words, I found your argument not substantial enough. Maybe you have another argument.
I guess I would just respond in that the fact that a part being defective is a judicial determination in a private suit between a plaintiff and a defendant. But simply the fact that the part injured a person doesn't necessarily make it defective. There is obviously the problem of people not maintaining or not treating the part properly.
Exactly, but that would come out during the court session, that would come out during the trial.
That's correct, but under this bill, there would be no possibility of streamlining the litigation under which the manufacturer might permit the sensitive trade information about, suppose they've been developing that gear over 15 years, and they wanted to protect their proprietary right to a revolutionary new way to handle the gear, which in a typical automobile, you have just thousands of patents.
Right, but don't they get a patent which is protected? Alaska courts don't handle patent litigation. Right now, you see, you can streamline the litigation because the manufacturer will release the blueprint of a particular gear in exchange for the plaintiff not revealing it to the world. We will let you determine whether or not, see, on this particular fact situation, was this gear defective? If it's defective, the manufacturer will change it. But if it's not defective, then it simply was mishandled. That's the litigation between the private parties. And right now, you can streamline that litigation by saying, okay, we'll let you look at our blueprint if you don't share it with our competitors so that we can decide on the facts of this particular case whether or not it malfunctioned, or it was defective. If it's defective, the manufacturer is going to change it because you can't hurt it. The manufacturer knows its responsibility not to injure people. But it's a question of the individual litigation between that plaintiff and that defendant. And if you pass this bill, you would strip away the right of that court to issue that protective order. The court would not be able to issue the protective order. And that would indicate for the manufacturer, why settle a case? Why engage in discovery if your secrets are going to be shared with the world? You might as well just completely litigate, which is why I share
the previous speaker's belief that this bill would require more judges and require, obviously, the pay of more judges.
Let me bring it to something that is relevant right now and tell me if you think this bill would affect that, the Exxon oil spill situation. Would this bill make it easier for the public to demand, for example, that scientific studies would be made available to the public? Because there, I believe maybe somebody could certainly argue that there was a hazard there.
I'm not involved in that mitigation, and I really am not too familiar with it. My only comment as a lawyer practicing in private practice here in Juneau now, I was formerly an assistant attorney general, it's my understanding that the existing rules of discovery that govern those studies that were made by the state are that the attorney general can direct his attorneys to claim that they are a work product, meaning that they were prepared in what's called anticipation of litigation. Under the work product doctrine, which is an established doctrine in both state and federal law, those studies are protected if they're prepared in anticipation of litigation. But the problem to me is that there are several exceptions to that which would indicate to me that the state will have a very difficult time shielding those studies from the litigants. It's ultimately the judge's discretion, not the discretion of the attorney general, as is my understanding. And first of all, because they're highly technical information, they probably don't fall within this work product privilege. The work product privilege is designed to protect an attorney's mental impressions and strategy of litigation from the other side. But technical studies don't usually fall within that legal strategy protection. And also, there's an exception to this work product doctrine called undue hardship. And if the plaintiffs are able to show, meaning I understand the native villages they're trying to sue, are able to show that they can't get this information without undue hardship, then it's also within the judge's discretion to give it to. So if this bill is designed to, it was my understanding that this is model legislation that the plaintiffs bar throughout the country is trying to push forward. But if it's anyone's impression that this would address the Exxon Valdez litigation, I would believe that that's misplaced.
Thank you. That answered my question. Do you have more comments before I open it up to more questions?
I don't believe so. I think that the summary of my comments has come out in my presentation. I hope that the committee has had a chance to review my comments.
Representative Donnelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to be real quick because there's people in teleconferencing, so I want to testify. Thank you for clarifying your memorandum. I think you will agree with me. It's very vague, and when you speak about motives of why somebody wants something, you have a first issue sponsor of the legislation. And I appreciate if you would specifically address that in a memorandum. Do you want to imply that the Model Act has some purpose behind it? I think that's appropriate, but not my move, since I've never met you, I've never talked to you, or anyone from your firm. Second, you mentioned that this is the Model Act. This isn't really the Model Act, is it? It's not identical to that proposal.
In response to that, I have not seen the Model Act. The information that I had was that it was a representative of the Model Act, and I would appreciate if you can indicate where it differs from the Model Act.
Well, I could run through. There's six. There's approximately six differences between this and the Model Act. But I want to do that at this moment. I can provide the Model Act to you, to other members of the committee later. You mentioned one of the primary arguments you mentioned was the copycat legislation. What's wrong with copycat legislation? Wouldn't that, in fact, make the court system more efficient if people could save that money? I know that I'm more efficient in the practice of law if I know how to do something. If I've conducted a lawsuit on a similar matter before, I can be more efficient for my client, save them a lot of money because I use my knowledge and that as a model to conduct the next claim that a client has. So since that's going to be an efficiency in the economy, what's wrong with that?
I'm assuming that what you're referring to is copycat litigation. I suppose that the danger that I would simply address to the committee is the danger that in instigating a suit, perhaps, of encouraging a person who has been injured to litigate, whereas I'm not sure that that's in the public good. Just because someone has been injured doesn't mean that they necessarily have a cause of action against, in my case, the Motor Vehicles Manufacturers Association that built the car in which they were injured. Simply because an accident occurs doesn't necessarily mean that there's a defect in the product. There's a great deal of responsibility on the part of the operator, you know, to operate in a safe manner. And I fear that there are times when there is an encouragement of potentially frivolous litigation because of the easy accessibility of information about previous suits.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing that I would hope that this committee does and keeps in mind is that there are various aspects to this legislation. One aspect that I think we should have before we finish our examination of the bill is really understand how this will affect the state as a defendant. It will, I think, have a significant increase on the state's exposure because the state is very often a defendant and in many cases is really self-insured. And I think we need to have some people here from the AG's office and risk management to really explain from the state affairs point of view what this is going to do to the state's exposure and what the cost may be. Secondly, since another aspect is entirely within the private bar, and this is, and to some extent, a bill to help plaintiffs. I think that needs to, and it has been laid on the table, I think we really need to understand the mechanics. This committee needs to understand the mechanics of how that works from the plaintiff's point of view and the defendant's point of view. This is in one sense, and I'm going to use the T word here, tort reform. It's a reverse area of tort reform, but it does upset and change a long-standing practice whereby settlements are confidential. And many people who oppose tort reform, myself included, were loath to change a level playing field. This would change it in the opposite direction, and I think the committee needs to know that. And the bar, both sides of the bar, need to be very, very upfront about that very frank about that. So those two aspects, the government and probably the municipal league itself ought to be knowledgeable and invited to participate in this because the municipalities are other target defendants here and this will affect them, but I'd like to hear from them and also from both sides of the bar. The court system, I don't know about the 5 or 10 judges additional that to be handled by masters or whatever, but those are two aspects of the litigation that this deals with, Mr. Chairman. But there's another aspect to this bill as well, and that is the aspect I was trying to explore with Ms. Nordale, and I certainly, again, she's a friend, and I didn't mean to put her on the spot, but that one of the purposes of this bill, from a public policy state affairs point of view, Mr. Chairman, is to try to ensure that these hazards are taken care of. And I think that's a very important aspect. aspect aside from the tort reform issues here. And I don't think that we should confuse the one with the other. If the goal is to ensure that public hazards and dangers to the public, regardless of how you define them, ultimately, are cured, that's a very, very important goal. And one purpose of the tort system, with punitive damages and everything else, is to cure dangerous instrumentalities or practices, to make things safer for humans and animals and other people and things that walk on the earth. And that is a very important public policy that the courts are supposed to foster, regardless of anything else. And I think the insurance industry, through its economics, are supposed to deal with that too. And if that is one of the things this bill is supposed to deal with, I think this committee should look at the issue from that point of view. What can we do to make certain that in the Sturm-Ruger case, which was correct me if I'm wrong, it was a pistol, and it would have cost less than $2 to put a little safety device in this. The people knew about it and refused to spend the extra $2, and they got hit with a series of losses, terrible damages, terrible punitive damages, and that should not occur in a good society that makes things safe for human beings.
And from a sixth grade teacher's point of view, was that information brought to the public's attention? It was not. So that
no, it was concealed, and that's why the testimony, and my former partner was a lawyer in that, so I'm speaking from memory in this, and Ms. Noriel, the other lawyers are correcting. It was well known. They made an economic decision that they didn't want to decrease their profits by $2 or add to the cost of this little safety device, and they continued to market this basically unchanged from the 19th century weapon, as I recall. I think it was without a very substantial change, it would have been a safety device, and it enraged the jury in a number of cases.
My question is, why do you all of you know about it? Obviously, it wasn't kept secret very long. The courts eventually brought the information out.
Right, eventually. Eventually.
It wasn't a settlement.
No.
It was a judgment.
Okay, so it had to go all the way to court, and this is the difference. You're saying this bill would sit there and say, if you make a settlement, you settle beforehand, then you've got to let that information out. Okay.
I'm sorry. It went up to the Supreme Court twice.
All right. If we can, we have someone on teleconference I'd like to hear. We're redialing on now. Were there any other questions from the committee at this time? Representative Baker?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg touched on a couple of areas that I have serious reservations about as well, and I guess I would appreciate a position paper from the justices and Supreme Court justices and I think the AG's office as well, because we as defendants on behalf of the people have significant exposure, I suspect, because this is a major change to the way we do business. Yeah. Not that it's bad. I'm not questioning that. I'm just saying that it is a significant change the way that we currently do business. And I think it has such far-reaching effects that we certainly should have the AG's office look at it significantly, and the municipal league, and then the whole realm of the small businesses. When they manufacture a new widget, there's an arena there. But I think this testimony has covered that. But within the state system, I think that we need to have some a long hard look at it.
Sam Donnelly. We're back on teleconference. I do want to take someone out. Why don't we
please
take
go
that?
Ahead. I just wanted to point out it's a very narrow impact on the state. It's on some very specific exceptions. Because of the Supreme Court case this summer, clearly things that aren't subject to very special exclusions from evidence are subject to public information now.
You're talking about the Daily News case?
Yeah, and they apply to municipalities too. But there are exceptions to that, narrow exceptions.
Let me take the testimony on teleconference. Do we have Mr. Paul Kosman? Mr. Kosman, can you hear us?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Would you give your name, address, and who you're representing, please?
Certainly, thank you. My name is Paul Kossman, COSSMAN. My address is 310 K Street, Suite 600, Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm with the law firm of Kelly Kossman and Associates, and I'm just here on behalf of myself.
Go right ahead, sir, with your comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and representatives. I am an attorney in private practice in Anchorage. My practice is limited to plaintiff trial work, wrongful death, and personal injury litigation. I'm not here, in contrast to the other lawyers, I'm not here representing an insurance association or motor vehicle manufacturers or anyone. I'm just representing what I perceive to be interest of the citizens of the state of Alaska. I'm not here in any capacity that will make me any money or anything like that. Basically, I'm just here to say that I think this is a very, very good bill. I think it's good public policy. And I wanted to address some of the comments of the other people that I heard. Unfortunately, we were cut off, and I hope that I don't say anything that's redundant while we were cut off. But basically, I want to point out to the members of this committee that this is not going to be a great big change in the way lawsuits are practiced in Alaska. When I file a product liability action or have something like that going forth in the court, all of the information that I obtain through the discovery process, where the defendant has to provide me materials and information, it's not confidential. I can do what I want with it. I can make it public. I can send it to other people. I can give it to the newspaper. That's the way things are right now. If a defendant wishes to obtain a court order making something secret or a protective order, that defendant goes to the judge and says, hey, we don't want this stuff to be made public, and we want a court order limiting its distribution. And that does happen. It happens not too often in my practice, but it does happen. There won't be any change with this bill. When a defendant wants something to be kept secret, that defendant will ask the judge to do it, and the judge will make a determination, just as happens right now. The only difference here is the legislature can provide the judges with a standard to be used in granting protective orders. And that standard would be if this is a public hazard. If you have some information that may save injuries or lives, the judge will be directed not to keep that secret. An example with which many people are familiar is the old Fort Pinto case, where Fort Pinto's had a propensity to explode upon rear-end impact. That information was kept secret for quite a long time until a lawsuit brought it out and then criminal charges were filed against Fort. Ford had made a determination that it was cheaper to pay for the injuries and deaths that it caused than it was to retool the vehicle. Under this legislation, that's the kind of thing that would not be permitted to be kept secret. There's been a lot of discussion about trade secrets and proprietary information. I would like to direct the committee's attention to the wording in the bill, and it specifically talks about public hazard. Now, our judges are competent enough to distinguish between trade secrets and public hazards. If there are documents that contain trade secrets about how something is manufactured or specifically designed, that can be expunged from a record. That can be blacked out. It can be kept secret. However, if there is a product which is dangerous and a company knows it's dangerous and there's documentation indicating that, then that should be made public, what the danger is and what the product is. There is no good public policy reason to keep that a secret. There has been some testimony before this committee that the public may be misled in some way, that perhaps an example of a snow machine was used, that if someone's injured on a snow machine, that all of that trade secret information will be made public. That's simply not the case under this bill. What the bill provides is that information provided by, for example, the snow machine manufacturer could not be kept secret. As an example, let's say there's a snow machine manufacturer who knows that they have a the case and this information comes out that there's a public hazard and that cannot be kept secret, then the next time that case comes up, there's not going to be the same battle over a protective order. That information will already be made public, and under the ruling the wording of the House Bill 171, it'll already be in the public domain. So it's actually going to diminish the secrecy battles, which are now done in a lot of cases. The courts are not going to be overloaded with a lot of files. Our courts don't retain the documents that are exchanged between the parties in a lawsuit. The parties retain them. And if something is considered not to be secret and it's a public document, that document's just in the possession of the parties. All that means is that the litigant can then release it to another litigant, to the public, to the press, to try and alert people to dangers that may exist and try and prevent some injuries and save some lives. I would like to stress that what we're talking about is not opinion, it's not jury verdicts, it's nothing like that. We are talking about information and documents which come from the companies themselves that are trying to keep the secret. It's information that they have come across. And I do have a list of the other states that have enacted this anti-secrecy legislation, and Representative Donnelly ran through some of them, and I would like to add a couple others. California, by their civil rule amendment process, has now adopted this. And as Representative Donnelly said, there are some other states, and I'm not sure if you mentioned Texas as well, Florida, Virginia, New York, North Carolina. There are a lot more that are now considering this.
Mr. Kotsman?
Yes.
Sir, I apologize for interrupting you. We are running out of time, and I have some people from out of town that I have promised that would have some time to testify on another bill. We're going to be hearing this bill again. If you could, sir, put your additional comments in writing for us and send them to the House State Affairs Committee in Juneau, and we will certainly notify you when we're going to have our next hearing on this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I should do so. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry that I didn't give you more time.
That's okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I had suggested that we hear from the plaintiff's bar and the defendant's bar, Mr. Cosman's obviously a member of the plaintiff's bar, and I would hope that he would have the time to join us again so the members can ask him questions.
And I would concur with that. It's my intention to hear this bill again, that this is a bill from the Judiciary Committee, so obviously it's going to have the ability to move right out of that committee. So I think it's incumbent upon us to look at the bill as best we can. I will be requesting the AG, the courts, risk management, and AML to provide testimony to us on the bill, and Representative Donnelly, we will bring the bill back up at just a time as quickly as we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Donnelly. I would like to hear, bring up briefly House Bill 225 by Representative Kopanen. House Bill 225 will allow retirement credit for unused sick leave for employees of PERS. 225 PERS 206 notes, one from the Division of Retirement Benefits, another from the Finance Division, Department of Administration. The additional costs associated with 225 will be absorbed by all agencies and government subdivisions making employee contributions to PERS. Since we are close to out of time, rather than hearing to the representative's office first, I would like to hear testimony from people that have signed up on our, I know are from out of town, so Mr. Bob Stallmaker.
Chairman, my name is Dave Stout. Bob Stallmaker was called away to testify on another bill in another committee. I, too, work for the Division of Retirement Benefits and testifying in opposition to this bill for the department. This particular bill is similar in fashion to what has been allowed in the teachers' retirement system since 1977. However, there's some basic differences in sick leave accrual and transfer of sick leave from one employer to another employer, which would make it this bill a little fiscal cost as far as administering the bill. However, there is a cost to the public employees' retirement system that would have to be absorbed by the employer.
All right, sir. We'll note your opposition to the bill, and we'll allow you more time the next time we hear the bill to for us to grill you on that further. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Karen.
Mahirin.
Mahirin. We don't need the teleconference equipment anymore. Karen, would you state your name, address, and who you representing?
My name is Karen Mahirin, Post Office Box 1073, Kenai, and I am president of the Kenai Peninsula Educational Support Association. However, I am not speaking today only for our 182 members of our association, but also for all educational support employees in our state. Retirement equity with other school employees is our top priority. A recent survey of our educational support employees in our district indicated that the two retirement issues that we are addressing here this weekend received more votes than a salary increase. In Kenai, our district offers absolutely zero longevity incentives. Once an employee reaches the F-plus step, they are there until they retire, unless a pay increase is negotiated. I have sat at the negotiation table and have been told that as an employee, I'm only worth so much. We all recognize the benefits of stable, long-term workers, workers who are known in their community and who are identified as a person working in their child's school. This work cannot be measured in dollars and cents. Allowing unused sick leave to count towards retirement is an incentive in many ways. It will discourage sick leave abuse, which districts view as a problem, and it will enable our educational support employees to retire with more credit, as we are currently only receiving partial credit for a year's work. Sick leave is an accrued negotiated benefit. Why should this be lost upon retirement? Due to another retirement inequity, we have to work 24 years to earn 20 years of retirement credit. We are finding that many of our employees who are close to their retirement age are needing to use accrued sick leave for either health reasons or family situations. Why not let them retire and use this benefit? We feel that other school employees have this benefit and that we are asking for the same equity. And we feel that this is just a very, House Bill 225 is a very fair and equitable way to deal with one of the inequities in our current retirement system. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the committee? Thank you. Representative Copeland, would you like to join us over here at, on the side? I'm going to go ahead and call these other witnesses so they have a chance to testify. Richard Barlow. Good morning, Mr. Barlow.
My name is Richard Barlow. I'm a currently I'm the president of the Mat-Su Classified Employees Association in Palmer, and I'm speaking again as Karen Hearn indicated on behalf of our employee group, classified employee group, and also for basically all classified school district employees in the state. And this will be very short. I think one of our main concerns is, and again, like Karen has indicated, this is one of the number one priorities that that our class of employees has, our school district employees, and is that they be recognized as other school district employees and that they have equity within the system as far as the benefits are concerned. And I'm speaking specifically about equity with the certificated our teachers and the benefits that they have in their retirement as far as credits of unused sick leave up to a year at retirement. That's probably the main thrust of the issue. One point I would like to bring out and make very clear is that classified employees perceive that there is no value to sick leave to them unless they use it. is no incentive for them to conserve sick leave to be able to realize some value out of it at some later date, either through a cash in or through or for credits toward retirement. So the incentive there for them is to use the sick leave whenever possible. So there's some value received out of it. I know personally in our district, and I've been there for 14 years, I know of employees, plural, who have retired out of the system with over 2,000 hours of sick leave accrued. They didn't get anything out of it. They lost those hours. I also know of other employees in the system who have retired. They didn't have any sick leave left. They zeroed it out before they retired. That's the only way they could get any value out of it. Now, whether an employee uses or conserves his sick leave, and certainly when an employee is sick, we encourage them to use their sick leave. That's what it's for. There's either a cost or a savings to the employer depending on how he uses it. When the employee is off and uses a day of sick leave, he gets a day of pay for it. In addition to that, the employer, in most cases, has to bring another employee in to fill that gap for that period of time, which is an additional cost to the district. If the employee is on the job, then the savings there to the district is the employee is on the job being productive and no other employee has to be called in to fill that space. We feel like this bill is an incentive for the employee to conserve that time because he knows that in the end he's going to have to be able to utilize it to his own benefit.
All right, thank you, Mr. Marlowe, very much. I'd like to say that I'm quite sympathetic to this issue. I actually negotiated a contract for the Kenai Peninsula classified employees a number of years ago, and I do know that teachers obviously are able to take their sick leave, and we accrue it the entire time we're teaching, and then after a year out of teaching, the retirement system adjusts your retirement benefit by how many days you had. So if you had 180 days of sick leave, you get another full year, which means another 2% on your retirement system. It's quite a benefit. So, Representative Bruckley?
Oh, I share your compassion and concern, and I'm supportive of the bill. The same, that saves money when people don't take their sick leave because you have to pay another person in their place, but it can also disrupt the school. The janitor's not there to open up the building. You don't get in there. So it's they're very important people and should be rewarded for not being sick.
Representative Copeland, my intention is to hear this bill further and hear from you on Monday. That would be all right, and hopefully we plan on moving the bill out at that time. Would that be all right with you?
Well,
would you like to say you can say something now. We have a couple of minutes.
Representative Kubina.
Did we have someone else?
We have several others wanted to speak to that
sorry.
Bill, but they took the sign-up sheet away from us before we had an opportunity.
All right. Why don't you just come on up, whoever it is that wants to talk.
When I came down from Fairbanks, I had talked to somebody on the phone, but apparently I didn't get on the sign-up sheet.
Okay, there's no sign-up sheet on the desk still there.
So that's a real effective method of controlling customers.
Yeah, we have
Yeah, would you please state your name, address, and who you represent?
Good morning. My name is Mary Lou Brandt, and I'm a classroom teacher from Fairbanks. I teach at West Valley High School. I'm asking support of Hospital 225 because it does seek to provide equity for non-certificated school district employees throughout the state under their retirement system. I think it's an issue of fairness and equity, as I said, because as a teacher, I'm able to receive a full year's credit in TRS for each year that I work. Non-certificated staff members are not able to do this under PERS. As a teacher, I am compensated for a full year. Non-certificated personnel are not compensated for times when the schools are not in session. As a teacher, I'm also able to apply up to 1 year of sick leave toward my retirement credits. And again, non-certificated staff are not able to do that. This past year, I served as the teacher representative on the Education educational support staff bargaining team in Fairbanks, and I learned firsthand of many of the inequities and unfair practices that exist throughout the state toward non-certificated personnel. Your positive consideration and eventual passage of this bill is certainly one way, I believe, to eliminate at least one of these inequities. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Whoever is would like to come next, just come right up. We only have a few minutes, and I'm sorry I didn't realize there were this many.
My name is Bruce Garrett, Mr. Chairman. I'm a maintenance mechanic in Kodiak Island Rural School District, and I'm co-president of our local. I'd just like to point out that many, like the teachers, many of those teachers will fulfill their career here, finish their career here in Alaska and retire. The turnover among classified or education support people is perhaps a third a year. And as far as the financial impact, it's not going to be, you know, that great. You don't have that many people finishing the system because of the low pay and poor working conditions that many of them have to work under. We've got some custodians working full-time that are eligible for food stamps and public housing. And if they faithfully, you know, fulfill their service to the school district and they do work there long enough to retire, they certainly earned that benefit. And we have custodians because they've so understaffed us now. They come in when they're sick because there's nobody to do their job and they have so much pride in their schools. And we have, you know, our schools are well-maintained, there's a lot of pride, and I think that these people deserve the recognition, and I don't believe that the financial impact would be, you know, appreciable on this.
Thank you, Bruce.
My name is Carol Burton, and I represent the University of Alaska Classified Employees Association, and I appreciate you giving us time. I got up at 4:30 to come here for Fairbanks this morning.
If you please, don't read your testimony, we will, and if you would just summarize briefly for us.
Okay, sure. Basically, the classified employees of the University of Alaska are in the same situation as classified employees of the school district. Faculty who are under TERS can receive credit for unused sick leave towards retirement. Classified employees cannot. This is discriminating against them. It's also in the case of university faculty, they hardly ever use sick leave because they can arrange their schedules that they don't need to. The policy of use it or lose it is open to abuse, and I think in the long run it will save the university money. And it definitely will stop the discrimination against employees that just happen to be under PERS instead of TERS. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry I rushed you.
That's great.
My name is John Sear. I'm the president of the MATSU Education Association, here representing 625 classroom teachers. When I retire, I will have over 210 days of sick leave that I will turn in for an extra year's credit. And you're absolutely right, it will mean 2% more in my retirement. There are, as you know, professional educators in the very buildings that we work in who don't have that right. When they retire, you're correct, they lose the benefits that they've accrued. I believe that that situation is unconscionable. One of the basic tenets of public education is equity. One of the things that we have always done and always do is teach that all members of society must be treated as equals. And yet, in our own employee groups, we allow that inequity to exist. HB 225 helps to address one of those inequities. Very briefly, I would urge that you support and work towards its passage.
Thank you, John.
I'm Susan Annis, 2118 Cushman, Fairbanks. I'm president of the Education Support Staff Association and represent 500 support staff in the Fairbanks North Star School District. I can tell you, same thing Karen did. Number one priority on our bargaining survey was credit for unused sick leave and full year's retirement credit. It's an important issue for the members. One thing that I'd like to say the Department of, or the representative from the Division of Retirement is saying that there are some problems with it. Members of PERS represent a lot of different kinds of employees. employees, you have Fish and Game Department of Transportation, as well as school district employees. And so I think, you know, they see a problem in terms of how to make it work. But I think with a little bit of effort and creativity, that it can work. You can establish some minimums that would make it fair for everyone and real workable. And so I hope that, the point that it would be difficult to work out wouldn't override the vision that it can work and make it equitable for everyone.
And we will work towards that goal. Is there anyone else?
Sure. Yes, may I?
Yes, ma'am, very briefly.
My name is Jackie Steves, and I'm president of the Totem Association, which is educational support personnel in Anchorage. I represent over 700 people. We, too, are very strong on this. I would like to point out that some of us that do work less than 12 months do substitute for the district at half pay, and we get no benefits for that at all.
Thank you.
So even though we work 12 months, we still don't get.
There are definitely some inequities. Is there anyone else? I assure all of you that came to testify on that bill or to hear about that bill that this committee will take that bill up on Monday. We will try to work out a bill that has the possibility of passing and gaining support of the administration. I think we just need to open their eyes a little bit. We'll work towards that.
Let me make one closing statement. I think this is the ninth year that I've had this bill in. The majority of states have this arrangement.
I hope not also. We do have one order of business to finish up. Representative Palmer, would you join us, please? Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Earlier in the meeting, Representative Palmer, the question came up as to what the two resolutions, the federal resolutions, refer to. They were cited in your resolution. We did obtain copies for the committee of U.S. resolutions SJ-70 and HJ-169, and they've been handed out to the committee, and I note that the Senate resolution has a bipartisan support, 66 co-sponsors, including our Senator Murkowski, and I take it there are representatives who have a question may have had some time to review the resolution in question, and I wonder if they still maintain their objection to the delay.
Mr. Chairman, I do not maintain that. It was just that I was trying to make a point that when we refer a federal resolution, I think all members of the body would like to know what they are if we're referring to them as supporting them or parts of them. So I do not have it.
Motion is in order.
It was made before.
There's objection, so the objection is removed.
Is there objection to move it? H.J.R. 31. Hearing no objection, H.J.R. 31 is moved to the committee with the individual recommendations. Thank you, Representative Homer.
Good job, Frank.
Quick.
Say it's a little spot.
Okay, the next committee will be Monday. At that time, H.J.R. 31 is gone. We will be hearing as the first order of business House Bill 225. Which we have, which we did not get, finished today. HB 167 relating to SEC voting, a bill by the governor, and House Bill 138 relating to appropriation to the Clean Water Fund and waste management loans. Okay, we'll meet at 8 o'clock on Monday. Yes.
Is that a definite, Mr. Chairman? Because my time is valuable too, and I think it's unfair to those members which are here at 8 o'clock to have to wait until 8:20. For the meeting to start.
Did we not have a quorum at 8 o'clock?
There was not a quorum at 8 o'clock. Not until about 8:20.
8:15, we have a quorum.
I have time. I have valuable things to do too. So if 8 o'clock is definite, that's great. But let's make sure it's 8.
Gotcha. I apologize to all the people who was late.
I apologize too. I didn't have a recourse.
Are you going to be here Monday morning?
Yes, sir. All my plans are to be here Monday morning, yes.
Will you bring my pen back?
You don't come into plane time.